Hello again. This is Sam Bradley with the Disaster Podcast, and I'm here again with Dr. Joe Hawley, and we have some interesting topics for you tonight. Dr. Joe, would you say hi?
Hi, Sam. How are you doing?
We're good. It's been really hot out here in the West, though. I don't know how you guys are doing out there in Tennessee. Pretty warm, too, I expect.
Indeed it has been. Lots of rain and some storms, but nothing too serious this time, thankfully.
What is your storm potential out there this time of year? I know it is hurricane season, but I don't think that's too much of an issue for you guys.
No, the hurricanes themselves are not, but obviously we're right in the middle of Tornado Alley, and that's not an uncommon occurrence here at all. So everybody's geared up and prepared for those kind of local weather events, as well as a lot of straight line wind and pretty heavy rains and pretty severe thunderstorms. So we've had our share of those in the last few days, but thankfully no major damage, just some minor flash flooding kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's always a risk, too. You never know what those rains are going to bring. Well, speaking of summer and wet weather, we're looking at some news topics today. I read an unfortunate incident that occurred with FDNY and their what they call their fast boat. It's their marine division, which apparently had an accident that they hit something and it went into the cabin and injured a firefighter. So we wish him well. But it just started reminding me that, you know, fire departments and EMS agencies, those that do have bodies of water around them and are involved in water sports. I mean, I'm in the San Francisco Delta, so we most certainly do. In fact, out here, when we have a major weekend, major holiday weekend, the sheriff's boat actually puts a fully stocked paramedic on the boat because we have all of these small islands around here we really can't get to, certainly by ground, and in some cases we can't even get there by helicopter. So it's really up to the boat to go out there and pick these people up and then take them back to ground to either the helicopter or the ambulance. And so having that medic on board is helpful to do that initial stabilization. So it was just something I hadn't thought about much before. It's that time of year, and it's just another hazard that we have to face when we're dealing with water incidents.
Well, you're exactly right, Sam. Obviously, water makes things very complicated, whether it's, you know, part of a disastrous flooding situation, or we certainly saw the impact that water can have in Colorado this year. So it's quite a powerful force and not one to be taken lightly in any sort of way at all.
So, yeah, so we have recreational water incidents, and then we have the disaster level water incidents like the floodings. And I have a good friend in Pennsylvania, maybe he's listening to this, he's actually part of a rescue dive team, and I've heard some of his stories on what they have to do. In fact, the flooding they had some years ago in New Jersey, he was very involved in rescuing people from there. So scary stuff.
Absolutely. Also probably worth mentioning today, yet another active shooter event at a school today in Oregon. So our prayers go out to those folks, and these things are becoming way too common.
Yeah, you know, I saw just a quick thing on that. I didn't have time to read the story, but here we are only days away from the last one, or certainly in a very short period of time. So that is scary. It is becoming too commonplace. And I'm so glad that you guys at Paragon actually are preparing people by the training that you're doing on active shooter scenarios.
Well, thanks. We're certainly trying to do that. You know, we're big believers that it's just a matter of time before it comes to a community near you. And, you know, certainly with the frequency of these events in the last few years, it's frightening how often these things are occurring. So yet another encouragement for everybody listening to get engaged and get your local community responders, law enforcement, and EMS alike to get going on preparation for such an event.
Yeah, and it's just, it's one of those things that how do you mitigate that when you're talking about so many different scenarios and different people and the accessibility to guns. And, it's a whole podcast in itself. And it's just one of those things that we don't have an easy answer for, because you just don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where it's going to happen. You don't know who it's going to happen to. I mean, it's crazy.
Agree completely. That's part of the issue, is you just never know what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, so you got to be prepared.
Yeah. Well, we hope folks would take advantage of classes like the ones you have at Paragon, which are for exactly that reason, and we can only hope that it doesn't happen, but like you said, it certainly can, and we need to be prepared for it. Well, we had talked a little bit about last week about changes in EMS equipment, and I was thinking about the fact that I've been with DMAT, 16, 17 years now, and looking at what we used to have to lug with us in the cache, there were a lot of pieces of equipment that we couldn't use because we just didn't have them. There weren't the levels of portable vents and that kind of thing that fortunately times have changed and more of that's available. But thinking on a simpler level, another thing we were talking about is last time we addressed taking care of our teams and how do we manage the safety of the team and medical incidents within our teams. And, of course, USAR has a cache. Certainly DMAT has a cache because that's basically what we do. As we prepare to help the ill and injured from a disaster, we certainly have a lot of medical gear to take care of ourselves. I'm curious, though. I don't know that we got too much into what you actually have in your medical side of the cache that you would use for the team as well as for anybody that you might, any of the public that you're working with.
Well, it's obviously very, very broad with an idea of being able to provide a pretty high level of care to, a significant number of patients. We're not quite geared the same way that DMAT is, and that we tend not to have as large number of patients in general as you guys do, but ours are potentially slower to be retrieved if they're actually trapped in a collapsed structure and that sort of stuff. So our cache is kind of geared toward a smaller number with probably a bit more sort of critical care and specialty level stuff than you guys do.
But you certainly would have the means of managing one of your own team members who got an injury, I expect.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly that is actually the primary mission of the medical team is to, first be able to take care of one of our own. And that includes our canine partners as well. So we have a fairly extensive veterinary cache, and we train our physicians in emergency vet care also. And then, of course, any victims that we may come across in the course of our disaster relief efforts.
Okay, folks, we took a bit of a break there because we wanted to add our friend Jim. He's with us, Jim Logan, and he's always fun to have on the podcast. Say hi, Jim.
Yeah. Hi, Jim. Hi, guys. it's great to be here and joining you guys in the kind of the middle of things. So pardon my tardiness, if you will, and carry on. I'll jump in.
Oh, please do. So we wanted to talk a little bit about equipment. That's kind of where we were going, Joe. And you know, when we talk about all the training we do, we haven't talked a lot about the fact that for our own training, occasionally there are these large conferences that are specifically devoted to USAR or DMAT or some other training for us to enhance our skills between deployments, which could actually be a few years. And you recently had a special operations conference you went to, didn't you, Joe?
Well, I did, and actually it also involves New York Fire, so it was the New York City Fire Department's the Medical Special Operations Conference, a relatively new conference. This is, I think, their second year to do it, but very well attended and a great conference that sort of had a lot of hands-on stuff as well as some great speakers and a lot of interesting topics. So some good stuff there. I would highly encourage folks to look into that one.
Excellent. I'm not sure I'm familiar with that one. That's excellent. But what did you learn there? Tell us some of what you might have been new and different for you.
Well, you know, I thought one of the things that was really pretty fascinating was we spent a chunk of one morning actually talking about sort of innovative new products that are flowing down the market, both for EMS as well as disaster medicine. And, you know, they certainly range the gamut in technicality and usefulness, et cetera. So there were a lot of really interesting things there, some new hemorrhage control products, some new airway adjuncts, ultrasound, all kinds of stuff. So I think there's several things in there that are worth talking about.
Well, I'm going to let you talk about them because obviously this is a level of expertise that you have, and you were there to see those products. So why don't you just think of the ones that you were most impressed with?
Well, you know, I think that some of the stuff I saw had to do with CPR and how we manage patients in cardiac arrest. Not that that's a huge portion of the disaster medicine thing, but certainly in an austere environment, you need all the help you can get because higher-level critical care is likely to be some distance away. So you want all you can do to get those patients resuscitated. The rescue pod and rescue guard have been around for a little while, but have really been, I think, gaining some traction with some recent ROC, RSC, Resuscitation Outcome Consortium trials that have looked pretty promising as far as the science there. But these are devices that help to create a greater amount of negative pressure or vacuum in the chest in patients that are either in cardiac arrest or even patients who, if they're still breathing, are hypotensive. And that greater vacuum in the chest helps pull additional blood back into the chest, you know, providing greater heart filling and therefore improved cardiac output. And, you know, you can actually sort of bring your blood pressure up by just using these devices. So pretty cool things to do, especially if you are in a pretty austere environment and don't have access to some of the more traditional therapies for either improving your CPR or, much more likely, taking care of a patient who's severely dehydrated and showing signs of hypovolemic shock.
Yeah, that's interesting because – go ahead, Jim.
So that kind of brings to mind you said two things. There's, you know, we don't typically think about us working those types of calls in disaster medicine. And then you came back and said, you know, the dehydration piece, and we've seen that a lot in the deployments we've been on. And so these devices aren't very big. If you haven't seen them, they're really compact, and the science is really showing that they increase the survivability of the patient, of course. So that's there, and it's small. It fits in for disaster medicine. It fits in your backpack, your fanny pack, whatever pack it is that your team takes, or whatever approach you have to managing those patients. And so the dehydration came up, and just kind of, you know, I often, when we have these conversations, I have these flashbacks, right, to patients that we've encountered on these missions. And so I remember at 6:10 and I-10 in New Orleans, we were extracting patients, going out, get them on the boat, bring them in. Some of them looked very healthy, but very dehydrated. So we tried to hydrate them as best we could at that time. But I had a lady, she's about 50 years old, carrying, you know, two Walmart bags, if I can say Walmart on this show, and just carrying her stuff, right? And then she just hit the ground. I mean, she made it to land. She'd been in her house for at least 2 days without any heat, with water, no food, without water, no food. And she collapsed. And she just didn't collapse like, oh, my gosh, I'm on land. It was collapse and reach down, check a pulse. No pulse, start a CPR, call for a helicopter, Coast Guard is contacted. In the meantime, we're working with very limited supplies. And she could have benefited from something like that. So we live in an age, a day and age now that we can have these things, and they're that they're really the stuff that's out there these days that are cutting edge is really going to help our patients and their survivability. You know, what we're used to, and you mentioned before, you know, we were trying to make things out of baling wire and bubble gum. And we don't have to, you know, there's people out there, you know, making these products and doing the science and finding out that it's worth their weight, you know, as far as the approach to traditional pre-hospital medicine and then the disaster medicine too. So I just want to throw that in there. It's something that you don't think that you could, you know, possibly you. We don't do cardiac arrest and disaster. Well, that's a bunch of horse crap. You really do. Because we
never
do it.
Know.
I mean, you know, your typical MCI textbook, you don't do it because you do the most good for most people. But you will encounter those times where you do have the resources, you know, later on in the event, and you can give your attention to those patients, and it's something to have the right equipment for that patient.
Well, and the fact remains, if somebody goes down right in front of you, you're certainly not going to ignore them, and you're going to do what you have to
exactly.
do. And I don't know what the outcome was on this lady, hopefully good, being as it was pretty much a witnessed incident. But we use those in Alameda County out here in California. The whole system uses them, and mostly on cardiac arrest, but I really never thought about how that would translate to other kinds of patients, and certainly in the austere environment. That's pretty fascinating.
Well, another product that it could have been used that we didn't have back then was a video laryngoscope, because you got to get the sun bearing down on you. You can't see. You know, it's just like being out, you know, on a scene on a bright sunny day. But these things are small. They're compact now, and you know, where we had to drag around a monitor before, these come in a handheld, one size fits all device that really can help us. So we live in a day and time that. With technology that's really really need to latch onto. And don't be so, if I can say, you know, for the search and rescue teams out there, you know, don't be so stuck on, you know, the traditional stuff works very well, and we should depend on that. But if you want to go out the door with some technology, it's out there that can be literally in the palm of your hand and fit nicely into a compact setup for your medics and for your docs and nurses.
Yeah, you're right. We've only started experimenting with the video laryngoscopes, and you know, the one thing we find is hard is teaching the old dog new tricks, you know, and they're kind of, even though I thought it was fascinating, you know, they kind of always want to default to what they're used to. But you're right. I mean, when you're especially in a steer situation or even a field situation where, you know, you're not working in the best of circumstances, something like that might make a difference. What do you think, Joe?
Oh, I think Jim's right on target. You know, that's a set of tools that were not available to us, you know, as little as 5 years ago, or were so expensive or so experimental at the time as to not really be practical in that environment. But I can't imagine, you know, practicing without them now, and what they can do for us, you know, even in those austere environments where you need every edge you can get to try to get the patient taken care of. So certainly makes sense.
Yeah, it's the edge, and that's one of those things that we try to bring when we do our the Paragon experience, when we do our non-embalmed cadaver labs and our simulations. We bring those tools into the learning environment, put them in the medic's hands, the old dogs and the new puppies, right? And you're right on. Right on the money, Sam, with the you know, traditional, the guys and gals that have been, you know, tubing people since 1974, right? And they can't make that connection. But so these labs let us do that, not on plastic, but on human tissue, where you can transition from, hey, this isn't so bad. I can actually intubate this patient and see what I'm doing with two fingers instead of, you know, not using my trombone technique, right? Trying to see the vocal cords. So it's very simple, very subtle technique, and we bring that comfort level to the docs, the nurses, the medics that are in our classes with bringing these new, as Dr. Holly said, cutting edge, you know, tools into the lab and let people, you know, get their hands on this equipment, and not so much at a show, at, you know, where somebody's hawking it, somebody's selling it. And we don't allow that. We tell we tell people that sponsor our labs and provide us product that, you know, we don't want a salesman in there. You should bring us your product to show this industry if you believe in it and you believe it does well, and it will sell itself. And it does. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we bring to the table with our education.
Well, and that's what I remember. We haven't talked about this for a while, but I did some audio interviews with some of the folks after the experience, and they were amazed. I mean, the kind of response, not just from the equipment, but certainly from actually working with human tissue, like you said. It's different. I mean, humans are different than plastic mannequins, let's face it. But a lot of the comments were, gee, this was great, I love it, but how do I get it into my system, you know, because they're kind of in the dark ages. And so that's always a challenge, is then how do you get these great ideas out there to the medical directors and some of the other people that might be able to see the efficacy of them and start using them in their system?
Well, I think that's a great point, Sam. You know, I mean, we obviously have a bit of a unique perspective because we do get to use an awful lot of product. And new and pretty cutting edge ideas pretty early in their development process. So we get a lot of experience under our belt quicker than a lot of folks do. And, you know, I think that's just part of the process. Our goal is that we hope, you know, people listen to this kind of podcast and have an interest in one of these products and pursue looking into it a little bit more. And would be comfortable reaching out to us and saying, you know, we're just talking about it. Just wonder what your experience is really like. So, you know, that's part of what we hope to foster as well, is just pushing the envelope forward all the time.
And that makes the point that, you know, we'd love to have people come up on the podcast and you know, if you're interested in any of this kind of equipment, where do I get that? Who makes it? Just come up onto disasterpodcast.com and contact Joe, and he'd be glad to, Joe or Jim, in fact, and they'd be glad to give you that information. So, Joe, what else did you see? I'm sure there was more than one thing that caught your eye.
Well, most definitely. One of the things that's beginning to show up on the U.S. market is the IT clamp, which is a really interesting concept. It was a product that was developed by a combat surgeon in Afghanistan to allow soldiers to stop exsanguinating hemorrhage pretty quickly and easily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the concept behind this thing is literally just a clamping type device that doesn't actually clamp the vessel, but is designed to pull the skin together and form a watertight seal so that the hematoma can form underneath it. That keeps the clot right around the blood vessel where it needs to be. And as the pressures equalize in the hematoma, obviously stops the bleeding, but has the advantage of kind of preserving downstream flow as opposed to a tourniquet. So it's not a product designed to replace a tourniquet, but it's yet another, you know, something in the toolbox that's pretty useful. And I could certainly see a real advantage to having something like that in a disaster scenario. It's very small. It's very lightweight. It literally takes seconds to apply. And, you know, in a patient extrication situation, for example, that may well be incredibly valuable to get that hemorrhage under control pretty quickly until you can finish getting that patient extricated. Obviously, those things often take a significant amount of time because of the confines that you're in. So these things are, I think, have great value in the EMS world and even in the disaster medicine world.
Well, I think especially in the disaster medicine world, and like you say, I mean, these all kind of originated from all the studies they did in the war overseas. That's why we have so many different types of tourniquets. In fact, the entire concept of a tourniquet, which basically disappeared from EMS for years, because we thought it was, you know, you're saving the life, sacrificing the limb to save the life. Well, now they're rethinking that physiology and came out with newer and better and quicker means of doing tourniquets. And now that's evolved even further with devices like the one you're talking about. So especially in an austere situation like that, especially with USAR, well, you may have somebody with a bad bleed that you can't get out of there for a period of time. This sounds like a perfect solution.
Absolutely, and that's certainly my take on it as well. So I can see the this being a great temporizing measure, and again, just another tool in the toolbox to try to take care of a life-threatening situation and buy yourself some time, buy the patient some time, and be able to take care of that despite a fairly austere environment.
Yeah, and like Jim said earlier, it's small, it's packable. You can almost carry one in your pocket, so it's something that's easily available, and it's not adding any weight to your cash. What do you think, Jim? I hope we didn't lose him again.
No, not lost him. I don't know.
The elusive Jim Logan. He pops in and pops out, but... Well, what else, Joe? What else did you see that?
So speaking of small and compact, you know, we also spent a fair amount of time looking at some of these new ultrasound devices that are now on the market. So these things have also come a long way with miniaturization and computer technology to the point now where the ultrasound probe itself is literally about the size of a cell phone and can be plugged into something like a laptop computer or a tablet and utilize that as your screen and allow you to perform a fast exam or use them for ultrasound guided needle access to central venous structures, looking for foreign bodies, confirming, cardiac activity, assessing a patient, a patient's abdomen for blood and that sort of stuff. So a lot of interesting ideas behind ultrasound. I don't know if EMS and disaster medicine are quite ready for that in the field. There's a pretty good learning curve to interpret the images and to understand exactly what it is that you're looking at. But I think a lot of that may be bridgeable with a technology that would allow someone on scene to use the device and then actually have the imagery being looked at by someone at a remote location. So basically teleradiology, in EMS and disaster medicine, might allow you to interpret what you're seeing on the patient from some distance away and provide some pretty valuable information.
I agree, and with the ability to pick up any phone and have a video conference, I mean, that's a capability that we haven't even really begun to build, but I think it's certainly there. I can definitely see this in a austere environment, in a disaster environment, not so much pre-hospital because, at least as it exists right now, because people say, well, now you're taking the ER to the field. Why don't you just get the patient out of the field and take them to the ER? But who knows? I mean, with community paramedicine and some of these different concepts that are coming up, and a lot of discussion around that has been, if I have devices like this, I can then connect my medical director to what I'm seeing, which may or may not eliminate that patient having to go to the hospital, or conversely, convincing that patient they do need to go to the hospital. So that's a whole new world that we haven't even really discussed yet because it's so new that we don't know how it's all going to roll out. But I can certainly see the use for that. But Joe, for being as it isn't a pre-hospital care device, explain a little bit about the fast exam and what are the components of that?
Well, it's just it's FAST. FAST just stands for the areas that you look at, and you're essentially looking for sources of bleeding in the abdomen. You're looking for cardiac activity and pericardial tamponade. There's a few specific things to look for, but I think what's actually even more intriguing about what you just said, Sam, is that you know, a bit of the difference here is that generally in the USAR environment, we have physicians on scene providing care and interacting with the patient in the field. And we also have that in the hospital setting where we don't have that quite as much as in EMS. And so, you know, in many ways, it's interesting that from a day-to-day EMS standpoint, the physician involvement is not maybe where it, you know, ultimately may end up. And yet when we move to a disaster scenario, the physician involvement kind of returns. So what that says to me is that, you know, I see the future of EMS having much greater physician involvement on the day-to-day operational stuff and day-to-day patient care activities of an EMS system, whether that is in sort of a community medicine kind of or community paramedic kind of role or just a bit of a expansion of our current practice model to include a lot more physician involvement on a day-to-day basis and assisting in making those dispositions of those patients that we see in our regular EMS practice. Obviously, there's great value in having a physician involved on the disaster side of all that, but I really think an equally large impact could be had on the EMS side of that as well.
Well, I think that's a whole show in itself. I mean, we could have fun just discussing what potentials there are for the future of EMS and how with all this new equipment that's emerging and certainly our video conferencing ability and segueing into community paramedicine. I mean, right there, that's a fascinating conversation. Well, we probably should wind this down, but was there any other equipment that you wanted to mention that you saw there?
Well, I think that was the majority of stuff that we spent a lot of time talking about. You know, there's some new medications out there, everything from, you know, toxic antidote type therapy to sedating agents and all sorts of stuff. That's probably a large enough topic that we might even just make an entire podcast out of it because there's quite a few items in there. So maybe we'll save that for another day and just leave it as a teaser for right now.
No, I totally agree. That's definitely something. And this is something a lot of people don't really know about how disaster pharmacology might be different than what we do on the streets or what we do in the ER. Well, we'll probably end it here then. We've talked about a lot of things, but I keep going back to that active shooter thing in my mind. I guess it's just, it bothers me that these things keep happening. And like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I'm just really glad that you guys at Paragon do the level of training that you do. And I really wish you could be everywhere. I guess you can be if people would call you. You could take that on the road, can't you?
Absolutely. That's well, I'm sorry, Jim.
I'm back. I jumped back in. So
okay, great.
The beauty of technology. I had to do it. Take care of something real quick. So I'm back. So yeah, we take this thing. We take this thing on the road quite often. It keeps us busy. But yeah, we really need to. And what we focus on with our hospital MCI active shooter is just best practices from people that that have put together programs. We do some hybrid stuff, but it's all backed up and based by on the fact that what we teach, like I said, are best practices, but it's endorsed by FEMA, the practices that we educate on. And the configurations and integration by FEMA, by the International Association of Firefighters, you name it, whatever association it is with response agencies, everybody's looking at getting away from the old model of, well, EMS and fire, you wait over here until we clear the entire building. And, oh, by the way, after that's done, everybody's pretty much dead. And now the best practices have swung around to, you know what? Maybe working in the warm zone with protection is the best way to go because that's going to save the most lives. And we're finding that out, you know, in situations like Afghanistan and Iraq and other theaters of war.
Right, and protection and training.
Just like we've learned, you know, throughout our infancy in EMS.
Right, and the training piece of it, and that's what the whole tactical medical training is about, and I've been somewhat involved in that, you know, the ambulance and the fire engine were always told to stage because it was always seen safety first. Well, in the meantime, like you said, the poor officer is bleeding out because nobody can get to him, and by the time we get there, it's too late. And that's happened, and that's why those concepts are starting to change. So if people have the right protective equipment and they have the right training, they're less reluctant. If they've got the – we do a big training. It's started as a SWAT training out here in Northern California, and now there's a very big fire and EMS component where EMS people actually go in with the SWATs, and they're protected by the SWATs, and they're able to get to officers down quickly, and they're able to get to victims quickly, and that's a whole paradigm shift, in my opinion. Would you agree, Jim?
Yeah, I think you're correct. And so what the best practices are now, the recommendations from the Department of Defense and FEMA and all the associations, police, fire, EMS, is that we fire and EMS work in the warm zone integrated with police with an initial response, right, that we're all on the same page. When we get there, we're all in the same staging area. We're all operating under, you know, incident command, under unified command, and practicing that, not waiting on the specialty teams like the tactical EMS or the SWAT or the TAC units. Those are great teams. Those are great units. But that's not the purpose, and that's not when it happens. Active shooters only last on average about 12 minutes. So the people that need the training and the way their lives are going to get saved is those first responders, that patrolman, that emergency ambulance, that unit, that first in fire truck. Those are the guys and gals that need the training. Those are the guys and gals that need the tools. Sitting back and waiting, we're going to end up with more casualties.
And they're not programmed that way. They're programmed to go out there and take care of business. And I've had that frustration of sitting there and waiting and going, you know, time is of the essence here. And so in a sense, pre-hospital is its own specialty team. So you're right. And I think one of the key words here is interoperability and the fact that we all should be working together. We should be training together. This shouldn't be a foreign concept if we get out there and something needs to be done. And what you alluded to earlier, Jim, was the concept of hostile MCI. So it isn't just the active shooter anymore. We had that stabbing incident recently and any number of other things. So that just adds to the level of the training that we need to do. And I just thank God that you're doing it, because somebody certainly needs to do it, because we need to be prepared for those things.
Well, you know, we're just trying to get out there like everybody else. This stuff's occurring. We just need it to be second nature, because for years we've told our staff and our students when they go through school and even in our textbooks, you know, we wait at a remote location until we're called in. And I get that, but you know, our world's changed. And there's all kinds of stuff out there, you know, the marketing for, you know, everything from a SWAT helmet turned into an EMS tactical helmet. Again, this isn't a tactical EMS, it's different. That has its place as well. But you know, they're starting to market, you know, kits for these active shooters, and you know, some of it's good stuff, some of it's, in my opinion, you know, it's expensive, right? It's some of the stuff, but what's the cost of safety? And I think the first thing we've got to do is make sure that we're training together, fire, police, EMS, in an integrated fashion, because for years we trained and we responded in silos. And those days should be over, because that in itself is a safety issue.
I couldn't agree more. And it sounds like we have a whole podcast on just this subject alone. What do you think, Joe?
Absolutely.
Well, we should probably wrap this up. I think we're probably a little bit long, but we could sit here for another 2 hours and talk about this stuff. It's fascinating. So, Jim, where can people get information on yourself and on Paragon?
I'm going to pitch that to Joe. Joe's got that down of all our social media sites and everything else. I don't have that in front of me.
He's got it memorized.
Go ahead, right.
Yeah. Well, you can certainly find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web, and Paragon Medical Group on Facebook as well. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and obviously the Disaster Podcast site.
Well, and I'll throw a word out for Jamie Davis, who's our co-host that wasn't with us tonight, but certainly you can find him as well. He does all the tech back end and all the posting for us on the disasterpodcast.com. And he is known as the Pod Medic on pretty much every social media site, as well as on medicast.com. He's got an entire slew of podcasts. I can't remember the number, but it's pretty astronomical. So just about anything that suits your fancy, he's got a podcast on it. And I'm Sam Bradley in the usual places on the social media sites, SamBradley11 on Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com site. So we hope you enjoyed us. We really do encourage you to come up onto the website and give us your feedback. Tell us what you would like to talk about, what you would like to hear us talk about, what you would like to learn, any information on any of the equipment that Jim and Joe talked about tonight. We would love to hear from you, so please let us know how we're doing. So, to end it, and every subject we're talking about lends itself to this one idea, that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.